Lectionary Lab Live is recorded by Two Bubbas and a Bible live from Gainesville, Florida and Brasstown, North Carolina. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Hey, man. Good to hear from you today. We're going to get in the swing of things, talk about some text, and think about preaching as we prepare for this 22nd Sunday after Pentecost, November the 10th, 2019. And as we often do, I'm on the road, and you're there at home. Sometimes you're on the road. I'm at home, but the show must go on. And so we're going to look at the gospel this week and supporting texts and move ahead. I'm interested to hear what you got going on. If y'all occasionally hear my best friend, other than Delmer, Rufus, my dog. In the background.
Your traveling companion.
My traveling companion. There you go. He stays with me. So Rufus may chime in from time to time. But interested to hear what you got. What are we going to do with this week's text?
Well, looking these over, and we're doing the Job text and Psalm 17 with 2 Thessalonians 2 and Luke 20. Mm-hmm. Is this all there is the theme that comes to mind. Not is that all there is, but is this all there is? Each of these texts touches on afterlife, resurrection, eternal justice, so to speak, etc. Job makes reference to at the last. We'll talk a little bit more about what that might mean, but it's for Christians, as we hear it, that's kind of a classic kind of afterlife resurrection text. Mm-hmm. Beyond the afterlife question, you know, as we're moving through these, we double down on the question of how the injustice we suffer now, and this is particularly thinking of Job, fits in the notion of God's eternal and perfect justice. So that's a theme. Mm-hmm. Back on this, is this all there is? The Psalm is another plea for justice in the long run. Thessalonians talks about the coming of Christ. Did we miss it? And how do we deal with that? And of course, Luke has the question of the resurrection and what's life like in that. And it sort of is one that's helpful to deal with questions of what is this all there is as right. The Christian life and what comes next. So those are main themes. As I said, with Job and the Psalm, there's some afterlife question kind of shifts more to eternal justice versus our contemporary and timed situation of injustice. And then lastly, on Thessalonians, I want to talk a little bit about seeing our lives through the lens of our purpose, our chosenness, and how that leads to standing firm and holding fast. So we've got a lot to cover, three different sections here, and I think I'd like to start with Job, if I may.
Oh, okay. Well, we kind of just sort of pick a text and jump in there. Sometimes gospel first. So I think that'll work well. Let's hear what Job has to say.
Well, because Job is of the four texts, I would have to say Job's the most literarily interesting and leaps out at you. And it has the most power of anything we've got today. And I really like it. You know, it's got that wonderful language. I don't think anybody who's heard Handel's Messiah can read this without hearing the echoes from Handel's Messiah, as Handel picked up on this. And this is, I'll have to tell you, one of the most popular Hebrew scripture readings in Lutheran funerals. They almost never have a Lutheran funeral without this text. It's in the recommended list right there in the liturgy, you know, and it's one of the popular lessons. In context, it's not really a resurrection text, although I'm going to come back and say, read Christianly, it's okay to use. So let's talk about in context first.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
So the book of Job, as you know, has kind of got an introduction and ending, first chapter and 42nd chapter. And in between, it's a series, I think seven, but I'm not sure. It might be more, I can't remember right now. But a series of Job's three friends make speeches, and then Job responds. And then they make different ones on different subjects. It's a set piece, so to speak. It's a way of a theological exploration of justice, injustice, suffering, and God, et cetera, et cetera. All right, so this second piece is a part of the second, this set in 19 is a part of the second set of questions in which we're talking about Job's response to their questions about divine justice. His friends, having said, you must have done something wrong. You must have done something wrong. All three of their lectures are about God is just, so for you to suffer this way means you've done something wrong.
You must have done something.
Mm-hmm. You know, and this, we all, what did I do to deserve this question? And they're looking at him and they're trying to press him. What did you do? Is there like prosecuting attorneys? What did you do? What did you do? What did you do? You know, they're trying to press the case. And Job's response is, I am innocent. I have done nothing. So at the last, does that mean, you know, as we like to read it, you know, after death and in the final judgment and all of this and all this language in here about after my skin has been destroyed in my flesh, I shall see God. All this makes us think of resurrection.
Right.
But that's more kind of metaphorical because he says in my flesh. And then we capitalize Redeemer here in a lot of the translations, which indicates a sense of, you know, a God presence, you know, because capitalizing words in English has that indication. Well, this word is G-O-E-L, Goel, and it means vindicator. It could be the one who comes and kills the person who killed your brother, you know, that kind of thing. You are the vindicator because you did blood justice. It can be kind of a defense attorney in a trial, the person who comes to your defense. And so
and another context that may be familiar, particularly if you do want to try to help your congregation situate this, it's the same word in the story of Ruth and Boaz. He is the kinsman redeemer. He is the Goel.
Redeemer.
He's the one who has the right and can redeem, can lift up, you know, can fulfill. I guess
it's part of that time and place is Jewish culture. There is a relative, a friend, someone who can come to your defense.
Right.
So what he's saying is, I'm doing the best I can. I know that there's somebody who lives who can come to my defense and can justify. And I wish this business about written down and etched and all of this. This is kind of like, I swear on a stack of Bibles, all that language about in iron and poured it and all of that. It can't be any more true that I'm innocent. So he is pleading that he believes in his own innocence and that finally God, someone will come to his defense who can convince God that he is innocent and all will be reversed, which turns out at the end of the case, he stands that way. But at this time, read Christianly, it's easy for us to read, and I think it's fine to do this. We hear it in the terms of, and I've heard this in sermons in various ways. So there we stand before the judgment seat of God, and who stands on before for us? Our Redeemer, Christ, stands. Now, the difference is we know we're, in Christianly, we say, well, we're not innocent for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God.
Right.
But that which Christ did for us stands in between our judgment and all that. That's one way we read this, but it's okay to read it that way. But in context, it is more about Job's trust that God's justice will be done mm-hmm. in the midst of the injustice he is suffering. Right. And this other language is poetic. It's really about innocence and justice, which is why, moving to the psalm is attached to it. Psalm 17 is a part of the temple ritual that has to do with a part of the legal system in which they had juries of elders. You can find this all through Leviticus and different places. You can see this description in which there's a suit, and then a jury of elders try to decide. And if they can't decide at the gates, as we say sometimes, then it has to be appealed to the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a part of the ritual of the appeal. And what happens is you go in before the priest and other cultic officials, and you make your case, you do this psalm, you make your case, and then they try to decide, and if they can't, you spend the night there in the sanctuary, and that means, you know, right in with the Holy of Holies, et cetera, being observed. And then in the morning they bring their verdict. And buried within this is verses 3-5, and the assumption is, it would be very hard for a good, devout Jewish person to plead in the sanctuary before God that they are innocent if they're not.
Yeah.
You know, are you going to lie to God like that? If you try my heart, if you visit me by night,
mm-hmm.
see, in context, by an overnight, if you test me, they're believing God will test me. You will find no wicked in my mouth. My mouth does not turn. You make that. It's like putting your hand on the Bible. I swear to tell the truth. It's part of that. That's why we do that.
Right.
You might lie to me, but you ain't going to lie to God.
Mm-hmm.
My mother said that to me one day. You might lie to me,
real hard about
but
that,
you ain't going to lie. You going to lie to God? That's the context of this psalm. Yeah. This psalm is where an innocent person who cannot get justice goes before God and says, I have, please hear my just cause, O Lord. I'm innocent, and I swear to you I'm telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I think it's helpful.
Wondrously show me your steadfast love. Cure, fix me. Mm-hmm. This is a really not at a kind of esoteric level. This is very practical level. You got to imagine this of somebody in a fight for their life.
Mm-hmm.
Going to the Holy of Holies and swearing before God that they're innocent with the idea that God could strike them dead, because that's the belief underneath all this.
Yeah.
And that's why the system is as it is. Can this person lie to God?
Right. I think it is a really helpful thing to be sure, and in, number one, in our getting our own minds wrapped around these texts and this idea, and then helping the people in the pews, our parishioners, those to whom we'll be speaking, to really bring this down from the lofty language of, oh, well, we know without a doubt. To me, the worst violence you could do to these texts, especially Job, is to say, oh, well, we know without a doubt that Job was given a vision of the coming Christ.
Yeah.
And as we said, reading the text Christianly is okay if it's done gently. Hearing this text with resurrection ears is okay, but I think we need to be humble about it. And I think it's helpful then to get to the sort of real world setting of what's going on,
right,
both with Job, both in the psalm. This is, you know, we're trying to figure this thing out. And as you say, I swear on a stack of Bibles. I promise, this is life on the line here. Ultimately, which I want to talk about, and I know we're going to carry on to the gospel, ultimately, yes, it's God we trust. We yep. don't know all the details, but
well, that's it.
I'm going to trust
it.
God with that.
And so the reason I wanted to do both of these first, because it helps us set up for what we're going to talk about in the gospel. I'm going to move to the gospel next. I'm kind of mm-hmm. doing chronologically here.
Mm-hmm.
So is that we have to put resurrection aside.
Right.
To read these two texts and think about what this means within the cultic ritual life situation of the people who wrote it, who are not thinking about resurrection. They're thinking about, here I am in this life situation. I'm accused of these bad things are happening, and mm-hmm. my friends are accusing me of being a sinner. Therefore, God has punished me, and I know I'm innocent. Or in the case of the psalm, there is a case at hand. Somebody's accusing me, and nobody's believing me. I've been through court, and they won't believe me. This is my last chance. Mm-hmm. This is real world. This is the IRS is going to take everything I got unless I can prove to them, you know, I didn't cheat on my taxes in mm-hmm. that way. You know what I'm saying? This is right. real world. This is real. This is this world. I mean, not say it's the real world, both mm-hmm. worlds real, but this is mm-hmm. this world with none of that other. And this is how this context is. And the question is, a lot of us, that's where most of us live.
Yeah.
Most yeah. of the time. And the question is, if God is real, and we believe God is, what does that have to do then with the vicissitudes of life as I live it every day?
Mm-hmm.
Did I do mm-hmm. something to deserve the treatment I'm getting? What if I know I'm innocent and I still get said to be guilty?
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, Rufus. Rufus is agreeing Rufus with me.
He Rufus must have is a point he wants me. To jump in on here. I don't know, but we'll leave him be.
We'll move on to the gospel. I do want to say one thing, and this just always is an aside. Verse 17:8, guard me as the apple of the eye.
Mm-hmm.
That's an English expression. That's not the way the text reads it. That's right. An English expression that comes from the Latin, actually. The iris of the eye is the pupilla.
Mm-hmm.
And so in transition into English, the pupilla of the eye became the apple of the eye. And what it means is the center.
Mm-hmm. Keep me right in the center. Look right in the center. At me.
So the person is the apple of the eye is the only thing you can see. That's the way the expression, and it goes all the way back to the 8th century and Alfred the Great and the first one, and it comes along. And so it's been a part of the English translation of this text for a long time.
Right.
And it has to do with the one who is the most important in the center.
And has passed somewhat into the vernacular even this day with a less than, what's the word I'm looking for to try to be kind here? We don't emphasize arts and these kind of things as much as we used to. But even so, there's an awful lot of people know that the apple of my eye, they may have not a clue that it comes from Scripture, but we get the context of it. This is
and the main point
me.
Is, if you're trying mm-hmm. to think of it in terms of apples, it doesn't work.
It
has to do with what's the pupilla in your
eye.
Are
you telling me, Brother Delmer, that not every word in this text is literally true?
I am not going there for love or money. Let's move on to Luke 20.
Somebody edit that out, would you?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's move ahead. Let's get to the gospel.
Luke 20, 27 through 38. So chapter 20 is the journey, as we've been talking about for the last while, is over. He's in Jerusalem, and he's beginning the movement toward trial and crucifixion, et cetera. And so this chapter has three times he's confronted by different groups of religious authorities and cultural authorities who feel challenged by him, either politically or religiously.
Mm-hmm.
So the first 21 through 8 is chief priests and scribes, and they question him about, well, by what authority do you do this?
Mm-hmm.
What seminary did you graduate from? Did the candidacy committee pass you? Have you been ordained? Do you have any paper?
Who made you God?
Who made you God? Well, yeah. God did.
Yeah.
That question. The second question, again, this one just says the chief priest, is that familiar question about, is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor? You know,
right.
and that sort of thing. And this is the one that starts with the trick questions, you know, that was, and this one is ultimately not exactly a trick question. It's just trying to make him look stupid. Says the Sadducees, this may not be a different group because the Sadducees were of the priestly class.
Sure. They're probably in the crowd.
They're probably in the chief priest that asked the other question. So the reason they named the Sadducees in this particular text is because the Sadducees were a people who very publicly said there was no resurrection.
Yeah.
They would answer the question, this is all there is.
Yeah. Right.
And because they tended to be rich, powerful, and in positions of importance, it was okay with them that this is all there is.
This
was all right. This was going well. They also, as conservative and traditionalists, only held that doctrine could only come from the Pentateuch,
mm-hmm.
you know, the five books of Moses. And it was fine to read, sing the Psalms and read the prophets and all that. But if you were going to base doctrine, it had
Torah.
To be mm-hmm. on the Torah. Okay, this is important. The Pharisees, as the other major group, had a wider canon and also oral tradition. They had more what we're familiar with when we talk about mm-hmm. Jewish understanding of scripture and things. So this question comes, is a logical absurdity. You got to watch the whole chapter. They're trying to make Jesus look stupid or trap him into something because they're against him. I don't know any setting in which we've seen a national, you know, in the capital of a country where there's lots of politics going on and people are asking each other questions that make the other person look stupid or try to trip them up and get them to say something that they will regret. Have you ever seen such
a thing? I don't know where we would find a current day illustration.
Current day illustration for any of that kind of
I don't know
of
where
behavior.
You could hide from a current day illustration.
No, I don't know either. Yeah. So we know what this is like. We know what this is like, is they're coming and they saying, okay, you believe in the resurrection. They come up with the most absurd situation they can to try to get Jesus to look stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. John, you ever had anybody ask you religious questions with the intent of making you look stupid?
Let me just say I have been in an occasion or two over the years where somebody was certain of their ability to prove me foolish by, yes. you know, using religious so-called logic
right.
or question.
I think anybody who's ever been a pastor, but most of our listeners, you've had that situation where somebody, you know, really thinks they got a great idea that explains how you're wrong.
Right.
And or... In Lutheran context, teaching confirmation, my God, you've got some smart 13 or 14-year-old who thinks they've come to the conclusion that shows all this faith business is crazy. So
they
anyways,
alone are the first ones who've ever
ever thought of
that.
This.
Yeah.
So this is an absurd question, and everybody knows that, you know, the whole down the line. So they're not serious. They just want to make Jesus look stupid. Now, what's interesting here, and I think a lesson for all of us, is Jesus does not respond to their attitude.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't say, oh, for crying out loud, don't be so stupid, or you're trying to make me look, you know, all none of mm-hmm. that, you know, mm-hmm. posturing. He just answers the question. He starts with 34 and 35. He says, it's not like that in heaven. You
in
know,
this age, that would
that's
maybe
basically
be an
what the answer
question,
is.
But,
you know, mm-hmm. In this world, we marry, we have kids. That's how life works. In that age, notice you know, in that age, it's a different world. It's a different space, and the same rules don't apply. You know, in other gospels, and I usually say don't bring in the others, but, you know, this sort of helps. You know, we don't give and take in marriage. You know, it's not the same thing. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter. And then he moves on to do a very clever thing that you have to know the setting that I talked about with the Sadducees. And the fact that the dead are raised, Moses himself showed. See, they only all they Ta-da. Like is
let's go right back to the Torah.
Yeah. So he goes to Exodus 3:6. You know, the story of the bush, and he said, I'm the God. He said, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Those people are dead, but he's still their God. He says it in the present tense, Jesus says. So he's the God of the living, not the dead, so there is a resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have any answer for that. And he didn't rub it in their face.
No.
He responded to their question with a matter-of-fact statement. That's not how it is, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And then by their own lights, he says to them, and besides, your own text that you believe, the ones you believe in, shows there is a resurrection. Now, the question is, what does it matter to us? I mean, this is 2,000 years ago, a stupid question by a bunch of people trying to prove Jesus wrong. And Jesus says, you know, that's not how it is there. And, you know, I would say it proved it to them. It may not prove it to me.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, so what difference does it make to us what Jesus had to say here? I think that's the key as we begin to preach. And so there are a couple of things. I think I would tie it back to Job, if you've read these, if you read all of them. Some of us read all the text, others don't. But I think the overall context, I think it fits within that whole issue of injustice and justice. What is the relationship of this life to whatever's next?
Right.
And I think what Jesus has to say is ultimately, in the end, God. Whatever we're going through, whether it's political, personal suffering, whether it's we're being falsely accused, things aren't working out. For the Christian, the issue has to do with a confidence that God will vindicate us, and this is not all that there is, that right. There is a larger picture that we're a part of, which I think takes us to second that, you know, there's the Second Thessalonians text, because the first part of that Second Thessalonians text has to do with some people in Thessalonica had gotten the impression, had heard that Jesus had come back, and they had been left behind.
They shook up.
They wrote Paul. Now, here's an interesting thing. If they wrote Paul, did they assume he had been left behind too? I don't know. I'm just curious. What does that say about what they thought about? Anyway, maybe he just heard they were disturbed about this somehow. And he writes them. And first of all, he assures them in the first part of this text, verses 2-5, he disabuses them of that notion. He says, you know, it's fine. Don't be quickly shaken in mind or alarmed, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as though from us. Somebody had written them a letter from Paul. Whoops, y'all got left behind. Now, you know, the logic of that is kind of silly. Let no one deceive you in that way. So those are words important to us. You know, it's always been, people are always trying to say. So if you got people susceptible to that kind of thinking, just point them here to this text.
Right.
You know, then there's a gap, you know, and between 5, where he says, you know, remember what I told you. Don't worry about this. Down to 13, because 6-12 is just more of the same, you know, of a disabusing of that notion. But then I think the most important thing of this is to remind them who they are and how they are to behave.
Yeah.
For this purpose, God called you through my preaching. You were taught by us. I love his, you know, us and our. So then stand firm and hold fast. You were called for a purpose to obtain glory. God chose you. Therefore, knowing this as a fact, stand firm and hold fast. Now, the question about traditions, we talked about that a little bit last time, and you know, the difference between traditions, dead tradition,
right,
and live tradition. This is not the way we used to do things.
The way we've always done it.
The way we've always done it. This is about not old ways, but eternal truths. Not old ways, but eternal truths. And this is what's important here is Paul saying, hold on to the eternal truths. Know that that lead to good works and good words.
Absolutely. A couple of quick things as we're about out of time. I love verse 5 in this passage. Which of us as pastors, particularly after being in a place for a while, has not felt like this? Do you not remember? I've already told you this. You know, how many times?
That's a cartoon I had from leadership where the guy's leaning on the pulpit, looking out the congregation. He said, "This is the 17th sermon I've preached on the transforming power of Christ. Why are y'all still the same old bunch?"
I already told you this, but I'll say it again.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, just in reacting to this overall theme for today and the wonderful details that can be dug out of this text, I just so happened to be reading the morning devotion from Richard Rohr today from his Center for Action and Contemplation, talking about how we, the church, get distracted with so many things rather than just living the life of Christ and so on and so forth. One of those being worrying about what's going to happen in the future and worrying about this person's relationship and that person's relationship and how, you know, do we, quote, get to heaven, one thing and another. And then in his just Richard Rohr kind of way said, you know, we really... I think we need to be much more focused on living the life here. He said, after all, eternity is God's business anyway.
Yeah.
And so much of this comes back to we trusted God. And whether you see it through that Job passage, the Psalm, the wonderful assurance that Jesus gives and just lets it lay there. Or Paul's writing to the Thessalonian church here. We got to do our best, and we got to hold fast. We place our faith, but worrying about the details, worrying about, you know, exactly how it works, and did you say the right words to a sinner's prayer, or did you do this, that, or the other? You know, eternity is God's business. We proclaim the good news and the glory of Jesus Christ, the love of God, the wonderful work of the Holy Spirit. God will do the work. So.
You know, different people see different things in the great European cathedrals. What I see is the hundreds of years it took to build them.
Mm-hmm.
And people who get attention, maybe the stained glass artist,
right,
the woodworkers for the work in the chancel, you know, et cetera. What I think about is the people who dug and laid foundations and stones who never saw anything more than a few feet above ground, maybe,
mm-hmm,
but without whose work, none of it would have happened.
None of it will stand.
And I think about the people who placed carefully stones up in the top and the back that nobody ever sees, but God sees. Mm-hmm. Most of us are people digging foundations, laying stones. And to do that, you have to be confident that in the end, God, it will come through.
That's a good way to wrap her up today, Bubba. I would with confidence say that I don't believe there's much else for us to do today other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Sally Gooden, performed by Nat Keefe and the Bowties. We go out today with God Will Take Care of You. The words and music are by Savilla and Walter Martin. The performance today features the musicians of Fountain View Academy, British Columbia, Canada.
Ask will be denied. God will take care of you.
No matter what.